What's up, party people? This week we got DB Andre on to talk about End After End out from Vault Comics. Issues 1 through 5 are out already. Issue number 6 drops on April 12th, so go pick it up. You will not be sorry. After reading that first issue, I was hooked, and I'm excited to go back to the world. Check out the interview. Hey guys, welcome to the show, David Andre. David, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
It's not going too bad. I hope you're having a good morning. I know it's a little early today on the West Coast.
This is my normal get up, and I'm a morning writer, so I like to get up and write early as like my brain's still kind of free of any of the stresses of the day and get stuff done.
That's really awesome. I that was going to be one of my questions. Like, so as soon as you wake up, coffee, and then every day writing.
Well, I would love to say I do it every day, but it's pretty much just Saturdays and Sundays right now. Okay. And I'm pretty good at, I don't really mess around a lot when I write. I'm like in, and I'm kind of a bit of a machine when it comes to that. And so my output is actually fairly good. If I worked every single day, I'd probably be less focused. Okay. So I'm not sure if my output would get like more, but like Monday through Friday, I'm usually running through story in my head of exactly what I'm going to get done this weekend. And so I, you know, in the mornings in the shower, working stuff out. And then by the time Saturday and Sunday rolls around, I have enough stuff that I've kind of worked out in my head that I can just bang it out on the keyboard pretty quickly. And if it's something, you know, what my process is now is me and Tim Daniel are co-writers. And so I'll do a really quick pass, send that to him just of a, like we call it a vomit draft. It's just everything that happens. And I really love dialogue. So I do the dialogue with that pass. And it's kind of, you know, a little writer's tip. Do the fun stuff first, you know, get that stuff flowing. And, you know, if you like doing dialogue, do the dialogue. And so I do all the dialogue or most of it, and then send that to Tim, and he'll take a pass at that rough draft and give it back to me. And then I'll turn that into a script. And for me, since I've already seen this material twice now, the scripting part goes pretty fast too. So, I kind of bust stuff out fairly quickly with 2 days, it's actually 2 mornings of work a week.
That's pretty fantastic. It's like, it's almost like a garden hose mentality where you're holding the hose for the rest of the week, and then Saturday, Sunday morning, let it rip, you know?
It just blurts out all over the page as fast as possible. Yes.
And your full-time gig, I'm assuming, is you're a PT, right?
Yeah, I'm a physical therapist. Yeah.
So that's really cool.
Yeah. And it's not a physically hard job, but it's pretty, you know, mentally and emotionally draining. You're working with a lot of people that are in pain all day long, and that you know, and they need a lot from you sometimes. And so some days I get home and I'm just emotionally exhausted. And, you know, Tim and I try to put so much like thought and emotion into our work that if you don't have a pretty full gas tank, it's hard to get yourself up for that writing, where that part of the story may be the part that's making you cry. And so I'm crying as I'm typing, you know, and you're trying to get all that emotion on the page, and you got to have at least some in the tank to put out there.
Yeah. My wife's a PT. So, you know, believe me, I'm on the, I know what that's like, you know, and she comes home after those lines. She works with developmentally challenged children, you know, so it's very taxing on her, and comes home after like that 8-hour day. And it's like,
and I need a little like decompression time. You know, I need a little bit of like, hey, don't talk to me. Hey, don't like, bring me any problems that I need to try to solve. I just need to like, I need to chill for a second and like kind of leave work behind.
Yeah. Little side question. Have you ever used Luna, the Luna app?
Luna? No. Is that for like, is that the, like a meditation or sleep app?
So if you want to pick up, I don't know what your PT schedule is, but if you, and I don't know if it's on the West Coast, but my wife uses it on occasion. It's basically like this app that like puts you in touch with folks who need physical therapy. And
oh, nice.
It's, I think it pays like $75 an hour, and you basically, you do just an evaluation.
You do
an evaluation. If you get picked, you get picked. Insurance takes care of it. And then you'll schedule this person like twice a week for an hour each or whatever.
Oh, nice.
And you know, when she was during summer last year, like she picked up like 4 clients and was just like after work, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And you know, made like a good extra chunk of change. I don't know if you're into something like that or if it's just like
I like
you're like 8-hour shift and you're done.
Usually 8-hour shift I'm done, but sometimes you got a little juice afterwards. Yeah, sometimes not so bad. You have pretty low emotional intensity days that you can kind of have a little bit of extra afterwards.
Yeah. So back to comics, good stuff. Did you grow up a comic fan?
Yeah, from about sixth grade on, you know, when I was in sixth grade, a kid that I went to a very small Catholic grade school. So there's only like 28 to 30 kids in my class.
Mm-hmm.
And a kid they moved from San Jose and he started in our school. And so it was like, oh, there's a new kid. And he pulled out of his backpack, like the first day he was there, like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comic. So I'll give you a little insight into my age. It was 1986.
Okay.
And I was like, what, you know, from somewhat aware of comics, but you know, like, cause they're at the time they're in grocery stores and they're on spinner racks in like 7-Eleven and stuff. But I had no idea stuff like that existed. I'm like, wait, there's turtles that are ninjas that have swords. This is amazing. And so from that moment on, we had a really great comic book shop in Manteca where I grew up, and just absolutely lived there. I mean, was there every weekend, all summer long, pretty much every day. Like the owner was very sweet and did not kick us little kids out that didn't have any money. Hang out all day. Yeah. And so, yeah, from then through like college was an avid, you know, all through the 90s, the image explosion, all that stuff. Right around 96, I was in college and very, very poor and ran out of money. So I stopped collecting for about 10 years and then got back in like 2000 and probably 2006, 2007, sometime around there.
What brought you back in?
I had... Even when I was not collecting comics, I still had a bunch of comic book friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would still go to like Comic-Con in San Diego. And this was when it wasn't, you know, I had my best friend, Sean Kirkham, he at the time was working for like Sony and he did an internship at Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And so he always had an in for tickets. I've never had to purchase a Comic-Con ticket on my own ever.
Fantastic.
And so we always, you know, you get grandfathered in, your pro pass works for how many years or whatever, and so we would just go and I would just go for the spectacle and comic art and like just, you know, we could walk into panels and stuff like that. At the time it wasn't the insanity that Comic-Con turned into. So you know, we went for a bunch of years in a row, and around that time, 2000, whenever Skybound was formed, wherever the Walking Dead TV show started.
Yeah.
My Sean's friend, Cena Grace, who worked at a comic book shop in LA where he lived, but also was Robert Kirkman's editor on Walking Dead and Invincible. He was looking for people to come help run a Skybound booth because Skybound was just created. The show was going to be launched, and it was like, that was the first time people were seeing the Walking Dead TV show was going to be at that convention. And so, you know, they're like, we're going to have our own booth. You can come work. We'll pay for your meals, pay for your hotel, pay for your travel. Everything will be taken care of. And we're like, oh, of course, you know, we're not going to pass that up. Yeah. And that kind of rolled into me volunteering for Skybound for about 11 years and Sean working for Skybound and becoming like the director of business development for years and years and years and years and years there. And so, yeah, that kind of reignited my interest in comics because I had to sell the Walking Dead comic and Invincible comic. And I wasn't going to be someone who didn't know the comic trying to sell it. You know, I wanted to have an honest read of the comic. So I went to bookstores. I went to Borders and bought all the omnibuses and trades and whatever I could get my hands on. So I got up to date on Walking Dead and Invincible before that show, and then been going on for like 7 years or whatever.
Yeah. And
so I got up to date on everything before that show started. I'm like, man, comics are awesome. And so, yeah. And just, I mean, if you're going to get rehooked on something, I mean, talk about like the best couple of comics to get rehooked on. So, yeah. And what happened for a while is actually I got all the Image comics for free in the mail being a volunteer. Yeah. I got kind of up on their mailing list, and like, I'm just everything, you know, East of West. And this was when all these great titles were, launching. And yeah, I mean, it was like almost another kind of golden era in comics. And yeah, that hooked me back in pretty hard.
You said that was 2006, right?
Somewhere around there. I mean, I'm literally terrible at dates and remembering things. So if people look up when the Walking Dead TV show started, it was the July before that, because it launched in October of that year.
Yeah. I think that may have been the only time I went to San Diego. I want to say it was the same exact year that you were there.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, because the only thing that sticks out in my memory, besides like all the fun that we had, was on the convention floor. And this might key you in if we were at the same place at the same time.
Yeah.
They had a giant Snakes on a Plane booth.
Yes.
if you were there, then I was there the same year.
That was the same year, I think. Because Snakes on a Plane was supposed to be this big thing, and everyone thought it was ridiculous. And the Walking Dead TV show and the Walking Dead trailer actually was the buzz of the show.
Right.
Like, everybody was talking about it. Like, we were not prepared for the fan response at that booth, because it was absolutely nuts. Yeah. And we had the entire cast came through and did a signing, like limited to 100 people. And all the volunteers are acting like human shields, trying to like keep the fans back. It was wild. It was great, man. It was such a cool experience.
That's awesome. It's always weird when that stuff happens at conventions. You know, like a little similar story. I would work the Dark Horse booth at New York Comic Con, and I've done it for the past God knows how many years as their photographer, right? So I'm kind of glued to the booth all day.
Yeah.
And one year, God rest his soul, like Anthony Bourdain was signing a comic.
I remember that. And
I've never seen so many, like, it was basically all the dads and all the people who were there not for Comic-Con, just like floating around with their families, go ballistic for this guy. And it became that situation of like, whoa, I know I'm not supposed to do this, but I'm helping security out, just like becoming like a human barricade to like this, like people are just yelling at this dude. You know what I mean? It was just like a mob of like that. When you go to a concert and you see like just like that wave of like a mosh pit happening.
Yes. You know. Because as soon as a small crowd gathers, then you get like 75% more people just to see what the crowd is there for at Comic-Con.
Right.
They don't know what they're coming to look at. They're like, who is this? What's going on? And we're like, why are you here if you don't know? Then just people just want to see what the cool thing is. And it was quite an experience. And I got to meet because the Skybound and Image booths were created. We're connected because it's basically the same company. It's Robert's imprint within Image. I got to meet like tons of Image creators and, you know, get to know them a little bit and talk to them about, you know, creative process and all this and how to get into comics. Cause I, back in the 90s, was always trying to like, you know, this was the time when people could do talent searches and get a job. Right.
Yeah.
And so there was Wildstorm talent searches, and I would write a script and send it in and I still have them, all my rejection letters and like feedback. Sometimes they would be really nice and give you feedback and stuff. And so it was like, you know, he didn't like with one of the letters, it didn't say this was terrible. So I'm like, oh, it wasn't terrible. It just wasn't right for them. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And you know, when reality and bills and stuff start to settle in, you're like, well, I guess I can't, I guess I got to get a real job.
And then,
you know, the comic thing takes a back seat, but man, it really reignited my fire to get back into conventions and like just see the fans and see the creators and stuff.
So that was your in, that was your way into the comic industry. Like that was like your initial kind of first step.
I mean, that's
right?
How I met. Yeah. That's how I met Tim Daniel. That's how I met basically everybody that I know, you know, I used to know everybody that worked at Image, everybody that, you know, worked at Skybound and yeah, I met people who were trying to do, you know, Tim was the graphic designer and designed all like the t-shirts and logos for Skybound stuff for a bunch of Image stuff. And he was also a writer and was doing kind of the same thing that I was doing, you know, he was way ahead of me. He'd already had stuff like published. And so but he was really receptive to giving me feedback and talking to me about like my scripts and stuff. So I would send him stuff. He would read it and, you know, give me feedback and really just a lot of encouragement because you like, you don't know if something's good until someone else tells you it's good. Right.
Right. Yeah. You can think your own stuff is amazing until somebody says like, eh, sorry.
Right. It's a weird thing about being doing something in a creative field is I don't get to decide if it's good or not. Right.
Right. Right.
Everybody else gets to decide. So it's weird. You need a little bit of that. You need a little bit of that feedback, at least at the beginning to make sure you're not terrible at it, you know, and it makes sense as a script and then, you know, you turn it in, you know, I self-published a bunch of stuff, you know, four different volumes of like a relationship drama. And, you know, when you start selling it or giving it away or having people read it on the Comixology, and you get some positive feedback, it's like, okay, that's that little bit of validation you need to get started. You know, they always say like, don't read your reviews, but you gotta get some kind of like honest feedback from someone who's not emotionally attached to you before you can really decide if you're like, oh, this is for you, you know?
Yeah. You could also, I think, you know, like if you, without being too sensitive about it, you could also separate reviews that are bitter and, you know, and like actually constructive criticism.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I can see it's funny because you can see, like, I really appreciate when they said this was not a clear part of the story or I didn't feel the emotional impact of this. That's great. I'll take that feedback all day long other than, yeah, I didn't really like it. It was, you know, I'm like, that's okay, fine. That's, you know, if you're going to write a review, write, you know, give me some criticism and, you know, where it's a critical criticism, where it's something saying this is what's not good about this technique or what you were trying to achieve did not hit. So those are reviews that are actually pretty helpful.
Yeah, those are better than, you know, like I do another podcast called Mat Men, and it's, you know, it's pro wrestling based, and you know, it's, knock on wood, it's gained a lot of popularity in the last few years. And then, you know, like sometimes we'll look at the comments and it's either like, hey guys, great episode, you messed up on this, blah 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 blah, cool, thank you very much, send them a nice reply. Sometimes it's like, what a bunch of losers, you know?
Yeah.
And you're kind of like, all right, man, thanks.
Yeah, thanks. Why are you watching? Stop.
Like, you took energy out of your day to write that to me, you know? Like, it's very bizarre sometimes. But yeah, like, I agree with that. Like, you know, you need that constructive criticism and also, like, that reinforcement to kind of push you a little bit because, you know, like, you know, talent-wise, you're not going to, I think depending on the person, you're not going to get worse, you know, like you'll get better or you'll plateau.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
and yeah. And I don't know. It takes a lot of kind of, you know, either self-delusion or confidence to start throwing stuff out into the world, you know?
Yeah.
So I think you got to have a little bit of either one, either that, like, I know I'm good, or, oh God, I hope this is good. You know, one of those two. And hopefully you're open to like things making things better as much as possible, you know?
Yeah. I think you need a thick skin also.
You do. And it's the weird thing. Writing is such a weird personal thing because you're putting, you know, like I said, we put tons of emotion on the page. So like we rip stuff out of our own lives, like traumatic moments. And like if you know, end after end, we were talking about a little bit that fourth issue, like all those flashbacks were stuff that either me or Tim probably lived through, you know? And so it's like you put yourself out there. So you have to be super vulnerable, and then you have to accept editing and criticism to change that. But you also have to be so confident that after you put it out, bad stuff people say doesn't bother you, you know? So it's really, it's a strange balance of being very sensitive to what someone is saying, plus not caring at all what other people think, plus caring a whole bunch that people like what you wrote.
Right. And yeah, it's like, it's a lot of stuff. And like, also, like, I got to sell some books, you know?
Right. Like, it's also got to be popular and fun. And yeah. And, you know, you got to try to like hustle it as much as you can. You know, there's so much on comic book shelves right now, you know, Marvel and DC. Yeah. And I'm a, you know, I collect Marvel and DC, but they try to bury indies with just the sheer volume of books that come out, right? They're just trying to give you 20 Spider-Man books, you know, 15 Batman books, you know, 12 different Superman books. So the, your dollar doesn't spread out into the indie world. And so you, whatever little peeping noise you can make, you know, say, hey, look at me over here. There's also good stuff happening in this world. And there's, you know, 300 titles that come out a month. And to, you know, to have someone, anyone say, wow, I really liked this thing that you wrote. That's, to me, that's amazing. It's amazing that you found it. Amazing that you picked it up and purchased it. Amazing that you took it home and read it. And then amazing that you liked it. I mean, that's like a tiny miracle every time someone buys your comic.
Yeah, especially on, like you said, on that independent scale, you know, like, you know, Marvel, people always like to philosophize just a little bit, but like, you know, I've been a lifelong fan of comics. I'm a fan of the big two. I'm a huge fan of indie books, you know, but folks always say like, oh, you know, like the big, it's going to collapse one day for Marvel and DC. Guess what? It's not, you know, it's like they're going to, like you said, they're going to put out 15 Batman books a month or 15 Superman books a month and 20 Spider-Man books a month. But also the reality is like, listen, a lot of them ain't that great, you know, like a lot of your core titles are fantastic, you know, and it gives you that love that you have as a comic fan where you're like, oh man, can't wait to read the new Amazing Spider-Man. But do I need to read like the X, Y, and Z? No, I don't, you know? And I think for me specifically, like I picked up end after on like a whim, you know, and I was like, I loved the cover basically. Like it was like, it was very much akin to like, you know, going to the library when you're a kid and getting a fantasy novel and you see the cool, you have no idea what's inside, but you're like, that cover looks awesome. I got it right here, actually. You know, like that first.
And that was Tim, you know, Tim's like, you know, Tim designed that cover and Sinondo like did an amazing job on the art on that cover. And, you know, Kurt Michael Russell, I think did, he might've colored it. He's the internal colorist. I'm not sure if he colored that cover or not, but man, I mean, Tim puts out a great look presentation. That's exactly what he wanted to look like. That old scroll work around the sides looking like a fantasy novel. And it's like, whatever we can get to have someone like pick it up and take a couple of, you know, look at a couple of pages. You know, I've always been pretty confident that the stuff that I write will connect with most people. And if I can just get them in the door, then I'm going to grab them. The hard part is getting someone to do exactly what you did, walk through, pick it up, start flipping through and give it a little bit of attention, you know?
Yeah. It's gotta be a little bit tough, you know, like I can only speak for myself because like I'm for the most part, like, and I'm an unbiased fan. And if it looks cool and the art's cool, I'll pick it up, you know? Yeah. And plus I get like a pretty good discount at my comic store. So it's not going to hurt me, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, like let's talk about End After End a little bit. So like when I got that first issue, I was hooked immediately, you know, like I really enjoyed it. And, issue 5 just came out, I want to say. Yes. Like that was the last one, right?
Yes.
And that's the end of volume 1?
End of volume 1. Yeah.
Okay.
And so there'll be a little break And then 6 through 10 will come out fairly monthly, I think starting in April or March.
Okay.
I think April. I think April, and then the first volume comes out in May sometime. And so yeah, so people can get caught up while 6 through 10 is still on the shelf if they want.
So walk me through it. Okay. First issue starts with William, the main character, right?
Dying
Dying
immediately.
immediately. Now, okay. So this might be a dumb question, but you know, like I read the first five issues like a couple of times, right? Suicide or accident?
The good, very good question, because he's kind of distracted and backing up, but
Right.
Walt also is not really it. Once you read four, you understand that Walt wasn't really having the best life to
Walt,
him.
I apologize, sir.
It mainly is going to read as an accident,
Okay.
but if you want to see it as the other thing, you absolutely can.
Yeah.
He just didn't, life never really worked out the way he thought it was going to. And so that kind of, leads us into maybe this is his second chance to get the life that he thinks he deserves, or that he wants, or that he needs, and some of it is like, I hope when people finish and look back, they're like, well, he, a lot of it was, per, it's a lot of it is perception, right? You can perceive things as being good or bad. And, while he didn't enjoy his life, he actually was doing stuff that he was good at and getting paid for it. He was a somewhat at least successful paid artist to do, it was kind of almost based, he was originally like a graphic designer because I just based him on Tim. And then we kind of expanded him out, but he was an artist, a struggling artist, and so a lot of his struggles mirrors just the artistic person's struggles, and like we were talking about, getting noticed and doing what you love and having people connect to your art and things like that.
So yeah, so on the first read through, and like I'm loving the story so far, and I kind of want to break it apart a little bit or expand on a few things. So, and this is a spoiler alert, guys, if you're listening to this, we're gonna go into it just a little bit, and pick up the book too. It's awesome.
You can't spoil anything completely until issue 10. I mean, that's
Okay.
that, yeah.
So it's still a mystery. So on the first read through, I read the opening page with Walt passing away as a suicide, as him. You know what? This is my final act. I'm gonna take a picture of it was like a floating insect, let's say, like a flying insect, right? And that's it. I'm gonna jump in front of this train. On the second read through, after getting to know the character, you're kind of like, oh, he's kind of a little bit aloof and not really, and very distracted and not really grounded in his surroundings,
Not really
And
connected to the world very well.
right, because he's kind of like most of, like a lot of us are, kind of wrapped up in your own head, Is it the case of him, just being like most people, tied to their phones and, just missing the point and really getting hit by the train,
Yes, that is how we originally conceived it. Like he's just like not paying attention, not connected to the world. He's like, oh, there's this, and he does have that artistic eye, so he appreciates something unique and beautiful, and he sees this unique and beautiful cicada, and which was a throwback to my other book, Resonant, and just falls in front of this BART train in San Francisco and just smash.
Yeah, and then he wakes up in this like I don't want to say like nether realm or limbo war world essentially, where he's immediately armored up and put into battle.
It's like if you jumped in a portal and fell into the middle of the D-Day invasion, as all the boats are landing, and the machine guns are going, and like someone just picks you up, hands you a weapon, and points you in the direction of the bad guys. That was the feel we wanted of that first issue, that, and a lot of people either, and this was a funny comment that we got a lot on issue one. We had people that said, I was just as confused as the character, which was exactly what we were going for. We wanted the reader to like be in Walt's shoes as much as possible and go along this journey with him. And we had people who said the exact same thing. They were like, I was just as confused as the first character as the main character, and I loved it. Or I was just as confused as the main character, and I hated it.
Yeah.
And so it was either that. It was kind of this bifurcation of like the people who read it. It was like, it was too confusing, or I was like, man, I loved how confusing it was.
Yeah, you know, and you kind of, that's kind of like the end of that first issue is what hooked me on to the rest of the series, you know, where I was like, you know what, I really want to see what goes on, you know. And there's like, you know, you're a comic fan, you know, like sometimes you'll pick up those number ones and you're like, I don't need to get into it.
Yeah,
you know, but you know, like I'm glad I stuck with it, and I would love people to read more of it, and you get like more, you get to know the world a little better. And for me, I think it's like, it's seeing Walt having a perspective shift, you know, like you were saying, his flashbacks, and like, listen, a lot of those flashbacks kind of hit home for me, and I know for a lot of people, you know, just kind of like, you know, looking at your work and looking at yourself and saying like, and he was an artist, and saying like, yeah, I mean, I could crank out stuff for money, but it's not gonna make me happy.
And he you know, never really finds that balance in the real world, right? It's either one or the other. And again, we pulled a lot of stuff from our real lives, you know, stuff that we've gone through, to like try to make Walt as real as possible, you know. And that was funny because that was a major change based on the editor. So Adrian Wassel from Vault, that fourth issue was originally almost like the day leading up to his death.
Okay.
So it was kind of a day in the life with a little bit of a time jump in there, but it was kind of like it, we had the same purpose of establishing who Walt was and why he was kind of the way he was. And I had a really great scene in there that I loved that killed me to cut, but I'll use it someplace else at some point. But it works so much better to show, you know, to catch you up all through his life. And that, you know, was Adrian's like note is like, this kind of seems too standard, too easy.
Okay.
And that's the tricky thing. Sometimes if it's too easy, you're not pushing yourself hard enough as a creative person, you know? So that was a really excellent note from him.
Yeah.
And he didn't tell us really how to change it, but he's like, this is not getting what you think you're getting across. So you know, we delved way deeper and came up with way more personal stuff and said, let's just put this all out there on the page, and it works way better. And Sunando does a great job, and Kurt does a great job with the different art styles and the coloring that take you through those flashbacks. You know, it's kind of this, like if you're watching it on TV, it would be kind of this like hazy, foggy, like soft filter lens that you're seeing the past in, and then back to this harsh reality of where he's at right now.
It always pays to have a good editor, you know. You need somebody to like kick you in the butt a little bit, you know.
Right. Yeah, especially if you're, you know, trying to do multiple things and trying to get stuff out pretty fast. Like it's easy to fall into some tropes and some standard stuff, and you always want to, you know, your first idea is usually not your best idea. So you need someone to kind of push you to idea 3, 4, 5, 30, 37, somewhere around there is where the good, unique stuff happens, you know, because it's hard to mine yourself emotionally all the time, you know, to really rip out, you know, your heart and put it on a page over and over and over again. But that, I think, is what makes stuff memorable. I think even if people don't realize it, they connect more with something like that the person got extremely personal with.
There's a lot of authenticity. I think authenticity always comes across like wholeheartedly, especially when you're, you know, like when you're reading comics too, you know, like you can tell, you know, cause I feel like it's comics are huge, but I feel like it's such a small business.
Yeah.
you know, if that makes sense. What were some of your inspirations for End After End? And also, I'm a big gamer, so I, after reading the first five issues, this is a video game I would love to play.
if someone knows how to turn stuff into video games, absolutely. contact Vault. We are willing to turn End After End into a video game, 100%. You know what was interesting was End After End was the first project that me and Tim worked together on. So we had been friends for 10 years, but we never really worked on stuff other than like him reading my scripts, me reading him scripts and giving feedback or, you know, trying to solve problems and stuff. But he just decided one day, he's like, hey, let's do something together. And I'm like, yeah, of course, let's do something together. And my only idea, and we both came with like a blank slate. You know, Tim has about 50 projects that he's worked up through, you know, pitches that he's worked up. I have like 12 or 13 that I've worked up, but we wanted to do something just clean together. And so it kind of developed really organically into this artistic, you know, kind of like this story of an artistic struggle. Mm-hmm. And I, the only thing I wanted was that first page, the main character dies immediately and ends up in this world where he doesn't know anything and has no skills, doesn't suddenly have a training montage and now is the best swordsman in all the land, you know. Tim hates fantasy. Fantasy is not his genre of choice. He's much more of a horror writer. And he's like, we're on the phone and literally he says to me, I'm like, what do you want to do? And he's like, anything but fantasy. I'm like, well, I have this fantasy idea. But we wanted to do a war story. So it's like,
cool,
overlaid on this fantasy is more, it's more like Saving Private Ryan. I think it's 1917 was the name of that movie. And kind of all these war stories that like I grew up loving, he grew up loving. Because it adds this layer of intensity on top of everything. And you kind of get to strip away humanity and see what's at the core. Almost like the same as like a post-apocalyptic story. You know, you get to strip away all the humanity and kind of see what people are at their, at the hardest times in their life, you know, what comes out. And so I knew I wanted this guy who had knew nothing and was never going to really be this great hero, but how could he find heroic moments in this new world? And that's kind of like what we're doing with Walt is trying to like find his heroic moments and see, you know, as a creator, you know, I'm never going to be, you know, Steven Spielberg or Brian K. Vaughan or, you know, Robert Kirkman. That's probably not in the cards for me. And it's hard sometimes to realize that you may not reach that top of the mountain, but you can reach a place where you are known and respected and liked. And, you know, and again, that's the funny thing about being a creative is you can think your work is as great as possible, but it's other people that decide how good you actually are. And that's kind of like, you know, our struggle and Walt's struggle is, you know, can we be happy with our place? And not that we shouldn't strive for more, but can you be happy with where you're at? And so that's what you'll find a lot with kind of Walt going forward.
Like that, that kind of like, do I need to have this hard conversation with myself at one point?
Right. You know, it's like he's always 2 seconds from giving up, you know, in the End After End, it's so hard. His journey is so difficult. You know, again, he's not trained for this. He's not ready for this. Just kind of like we're born into life, not like trained for it or ready for it. He's already tried one time to have a life and it didn't work out. And now he's got to try again. And so it's like, what are those things that keep you going and why don't you quit? And so, yeah, trying to get into a lot of that with End After End. So it was mainly those themes that started to come out with when me and Tim were discussing like Walt's journey, and we started to see the parallels. And then we, you know, once you start to see those parallels and themes that mean a lot to you, you just lean into them, you know, and that's what the story becomes about.
That's refreshing to hear too, you know, just like the realness of it. And, you know, I like it. What you said about the war stories really comes across, I think, especially in issue 5, which is one of my favorite issues so far with Walt and the, how did you have him scripted? Like, was it like the unknown swordsman or just
the enemy? He was the enemy.
Yes. And you know, Walt saying like, holy shit, wait a minute, you're human. And he's like, I don't even know what that means anymore. If I don't kill you, I'm going to be eaten later.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, you kind of see like the two sides of the fronts that they're on, you know? And like, it just, what you were saying, it reminded me of like, you know, sometimes you hear those stories from like World War I or World War II, where it's like soldier versus soldier. And they're just like, listen, man, like I don't want to kill you, but I have to, like, this is, you know, in I'm the good guy. And you're the bad guy, you know, like on both ends of it, you know?
Right. Yeah. And that issue came to me pretty early in the process. And we also called it the Gorn issue because it's like Captain Kirk on the planet with the Gorn. And it's this, you know, the kind of the bottle episode where you just have those two, you've had this massive cast of characters and you have these two. And it always kind of happens in war movies too. And I think, you know, directors and writers of war movies bring that in to remind the viewer that there's these huge explosions and planes crashing and ships blowing up, but there's people, there's like each one of those is a person that had hopes and dreams and wanted to do all these things. And it was also Walt's time to realize that as bad as he thinks he has it, and he always is kind of that dour, oh poor is me, someone always has it worse, you know, and he showed up and he got a mentor, and he's, you know, with a group of humanoid type people. And this other guy shows up and he's with the Reek, the bad guys.
Yeah,
and it's like, oh, okay. He like, your life was pretty hard compared to my afterlife, you know, the afterlife versus afterlife. It's not equal to. So yeah, that was my favorite issue. I like couldn't wait to start writing that one, 'cause that one had like solidified in my brain almost immediately. Like, we had come up with the beginning, we had come up with the ending within our first conversation, our first like 5.5 hour conversation. We had plotted out like the beginning and end. And then I'm like, and I know I want this. And so almost the first day I knew I wanted this, this scene, this issue of this kind of mano-a-mano, you know, one-on-one, really grounded and kind of almost a birthing scene where it's so brutal, you know, that Walt kind of comes out of that, you know, reborn and a slightly better or different attitude.
I love that one panel in there too, after he thrusts the sword into the enemy, that he just kind of, it made it seem like he just hung on until night fell.
Yeah.
You know, with like him just, like, pinned against the tree.
Yeah. It's they're both either exhausted and hurt and just as worn out as physically possible. Yeah. I wanted to get that across, and Sonata did a great job with that whole issue.
How long do you guys foresee this going? Cause I like one of the characters that I definitely want to know the origin of is the maniac, Stills, right? That's
who of course is my favorite, you know, once you start writing the crazy person, yeah, they become your favorite. It's going to be 10 issues. So we got 5 more issues to go.
Okay.
The Walt's story, Still's story, all these character stories will mostly be wrapped up by then. It's going to have an...
Okay.
Like I said, we found the ending pretty much the same time we found the beginning. And, you know, with current comics, you got to kind of plan on things going about 5 or 10 issues. And that's just the... You know, every once in a while you get, you know, something that's killing the children or something that gets to run a little bit longer. But the majority of stuff you'll see out from indie publishers is 5 issues, 4 issues.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just because you get attrition. And so, you know, you get a ton of people buying number ones and then maybe 30% buy number twos. So it's, you start to lose you start to lose money, and it is still a business. So when we talk about, you know, Marvel and DC trying to just push indies out of the, you know, off the wall, that's what happens, you know. And so if you're going to spend $4 or $5 on a comic, you know, that Marvel comic, great, they don't really need your money.
Right. But
if you want indie comics to, I'm not talking about my comics, I'm talking about indie, if you want indie comics and indie publishers to last, those dollars go a lot further, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It makes a huge difference if 10 more people buy my book.
Yeah, no, it's the irony of that kind of machine, you know, where it's like, like you said, Marvel and DC don't need your money to buy comics. No. You know, like they do not, you know, like there's no, but they'll still crank out stuff that, you know, I'll look at a lot of solicits and be like, well, this isn't for me, and that's fine. But why? Like, why are they putting this out? This is terrible.
Because someone's going to buy it, and it's going to push an indie comic a little bit further off to the side. You know, and comic owners are under, you know, comic shop owners are under a tough business model as well. They got to buy stuff that's going to sell. You can't have comics sitting on the shelves. You know, they need to buy 75 to 90% of what they order. So you can stick a Spider-Man title out there and be guaranteed that you're going to sell all of them, or you can take a chance on some indie stuff. So any comic shop that takes a chance on indie stuff, I'm really grateful for. And, you know, there's still shops where companies like Vault and, you know, are not even on shelves. So it's awesome that we get so much support from fans that are kind of like, hey, pushing to the shop owners. If you guys pre-order books, that's the number one thing. And so if you want to support indie comics, pre-order those books and put them on your pull list. And if shop owners see it on the pull list, they'll not only order one for you, they usually order more for the shelf if there's a big interest in those. So it's a weird freaking business that you have to, you have to commit yourself to a series before you can even read it. And that's why Vault, you know, has made it a practice of letting you read number ones before they come out. You know, all you got to do is follow like Adrian or Vault on Twitter, and they'll, you know, they'll give you the number one. We'll let you read the number one before it even comes out. And I, you know, I don't have a problem with that at all. Like everybody just read it, because, you know, again, you have to have that confidence that if you read it, you're going to like it enough to come back for number two. And so I fully support letting people read those number ones.
Vault has definitely, personally, I feel like Vault has definitely come a long way as a publisher in my eyes, where I'm like, you know what? Like, they've got a bit of that, like they got a bit of that image magic of, like, for the most part in the last, let's say, like 10 or 15 years, most number ones that Image has put out have been pretty great, you know?
Yeah.
And I think Vault has that same trend where it's like most of the stuff you're getting is very high quality. You know, there are a couple of, for me personally, again, there's a couple of misses in there, but for the most part, pretty fantastic books. Do you have more in the tank for End After End in case there's some kind of upswing or fans want more, kind of like, Kieran Gillen's Once in Future, where that was supposed to be a limited series and then he took it to issue 30.
Yeah. And Dan Mora on that series is probably my favorite artist working right now. That guy's a stud.
Yeah.
And he seems to be able to draw 23 comics a month because I'm like, how are you doing this, dude?
Cranking it out, too.
Yeah. You're never going to shut the door, you know, on anything. You know, so while, like we said, the End After End exists as a universe, and you make it to issue 10, there's a little bit of hint out there that there maybe are other ends after ends.
Okay.
Like, Walt, you know, just like there's different religions and different afterworlds and different religions, they may not all be like Walt's world that he fell into. So, yeah, we're not going to close the door on it, of course. You know, with, like, again, with my first series Resonant, it came to an end at 10, but I wrote 15 issues.
Okay.
You know, so as a creative, if you love, I mean, you love your stuff you wrote. I mean, I love everything that I wrote, right? Because I wouldn't spend my free time working on it if I didn't love it. I'm always ready to go back and play around in those sandboxes again.
And it's got to be cool to have something that you made in your hands.
Dude, it's the most amazing thing. It's still unfathomable that you can buy my comic at your comic book shop.
Right, yeah, it's
Like,
nuts
that
when you think
is
about it.
weird, man. I'm going from where I hand sold all my self-published comics,
Yeah.
to people at conventions and like over the internet, and going to where people can, people in England are reading it, or people on in different countries on Comixology are reading it. That's freaking bizarre, man. That is so, it's, I haven't gotten over that, like, that release day excitement yet, where it's like, oh, I got a comic in comic shops and people are walking by it and looking at it. And I'm like, please pick it up and buy it.
It's awesome. Have you gone to shops like that are not local to you and seen your book there?
Oh yeah. That's the first thing I look for at any shop. I'll be down in LA in a couple of weeks for WonderCon,
Yeah.
and I'm sure I'm going to go to a couple of comic book shops, and if I see my book, I'm bringing it to the front and like making some space and making its own little display. If you don't have my book in your shop, I'm very upset.
You got to do the move. You got to do that classic move of like, hey, listen, let me sign a bunch of these for you and
Oh
you
yeah,
take a bunch of free stuff.
right, I've done that. I'm done. Look, I wrote this. Can you mind if I sign a bunch? And they're like, oh, sure. And like, yeah, that's, it's a weird, you could probably, anybody could probably do that for any book, go in and say, hey, I wrote this. Can I sign?
It's you're probably right about that, but I don't
One's
think.
checked my ID. No one's ever checked my ID when I've done that.
So you're going to WonderCon in Anaheim. Are you tabling there or are you attending?
I'm attending. I
Okay.
don't know. I just kind of decided this weekend that I'm gonna go. So I don't know if Vault's gonna have a booth. I don't know if anyone's gonna have a booth. I will absolutely try to do some signings if that is the case. I will. So I'm gonna try to see if I can get on some panels and chat.
Awesome.
And I will always have like exclusives, because I have my own exclusives when I've done, Resonant and After End. I've done my own kind of print run that I get all the comics, and so you can only buy them through me. And so I'll always have my exclusive comics with me at shows, willing
Awesome.
to sell it out of my backpack or whatever I got.
Are you gonna do the East Coast and come to the New York Comic Con?
My free ride with Skybound has kind of ended, because they don't booth like they used to. So that becomes like really expensive. So I would have to make a little more money, or get like hosted. Like, hey, we'll pick up your hotel room or whatever. I love New York Comic Con. It was one of the most stressful cons to work the first couple of years. And they've kind of smoothed things out quite a bit and turned it into a pretty cool con. So now I kind of enjoy going to it. I dreaded it for the first couple of years, but now I kind of like, yeah, this is cool. So I would love to do the whole con circuit. I'm a big fan of cons.
Yeah, same here.
I love meeting like, fans. It's so weird for me to say that word. But how about people that like my books? I think it's really cool to find someone who likes my books, and like, yeah, I love that aspect. I'll hand sell to anybody, and I've, that's kind of that's my jam. That's where I get my juice. Like, people coming up and saying, man, I really liked your book. I'm like, that is freaking amazing,
I do think comic creators, publishers need to put them more face forward as far as like, this is what this person looks like, because I feel like, I've been to conventions where buddies of mine have been like, oh shit, that's like so and so. And I'm like, I have no idea what that dude looks like, or like, I don't know what that lady looks like at all, because it's like, listen, not for nothing. Everybody looks like us. Well, this is like a how old are you?
I'm 48.
Yeah, I'm 41. It's dudes in their 40s with beards and glasses. Everybody looks the fucking same, you know?
Right. So, yeah, exactly.
Like, it's perpetually, like, I remember one of the folks at the Dark Horse booth, one of the first years I was working, she was like, "Why are you here again?" I was like, "Oh, I'm doing the pictures for you guys." She's like, "Oh, I thought you were a creator. You all look exactly the same."
Yes. Like, 100%. Right, you know? Yeah. There's very little differentiation.
Yeah. But I do think like folks' pictures need to be put like on their work. So, you know what? Like, so the cool stuff like that could happen more. Like, you know, you could be walking around and somebody would be like, "Oh shit, like David Andrew, like, yeah, you know, I really like this. I really like Resident. I like End After End, you know, like talk to me." I got one important question and then I'm going to wrap it up with you, David.
All right.
What is your favorite sandwich?
Oh, my favorite sandwich. That's funny. I've had that question before on podcasts. I will answer in a couple of ways. One, not a hot dog, because a hot dog is not a sandwich.
Okay.
I will die on that hill.
Do you consider a hot dog more of a taco?
I consider it its own sausage delivery system. There is a place in Sacramento, and it's a small, I think it's a chain on like West Coast and maybe even out into Hawaii, called Ike's Love and Sandwich. And they have a fried chicken sandwich that has this like golden ranch kind of spread on it with pickled jalapenos and pickles. And it is the best. Like, people went nuts over like the Popeye sandwich and stuff like that, and this is like that times a thousand. It's the best thing I've ever eaten in my life.
That sounds amazing.
It's amazing. And they like have fry the chicken, but like, it's not like, "Oh, these are some frozen ass chicken strips we're gonna throw on there." Everything's fairly fresh, as much as you can for like a fast food kind of sandwich, Subway type thing. And it's an amazing sandwich. And they have some great stuff on their menu in general. But that is, man, one of the best. There's a deli in Sacramento too that has a really great pastrami sandwich that you get a good pastrami sandwich, man. That's knocking it out of the park right there.
It's kind of heaven.
Yeah. It doesn't get much better. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if you're it's not an everyday thing, because I feel like, you know, if you're in the mood for something salty, pastrami sandwich.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. A chicken sandwich also wins. Like, I have a similar chicken sandwich story, sort of. There's this thing in New York, in Brooklyn, called Smorgasburg, right? And it's a bunch of, I think they're all over the place at this point, but it's a bunch of pop-up food stands from like different restaurants or like independent folks putting their food out. And I was just like, "All right, what am I gonna eat?" And I see a sign and it says best chicken sandwich you'll ever have, and it was called a Sando Calrissian. And as a nerd, I'm like, I think I found what my lunch is. I'm going by name alone. It was the greatest chicken sandwich I ever had. And I was talking to the guys and they were like, "Yeah, we don't have a storefront, like it's pop-ups, blah blah blah." Long story short, we exchange information. My full-time gig is a photographer. And I was like, "When you have a storefront, keep in touch with me. I will shoot all your food. Just give me food to take home." And 2 years later, it happened, you know? And they were like, "We can't believe we stayed in touch for like 2 years." And I was like, "Just give me that sandwich, dude. Like, give me more, you know?"
Yeah.
Unbeatable.
100%. We'll work for food. That was the best. That was the great thing about working, you know, the booth for Skybound. They take us out to dinners and stuff afterwards, and you get like really good food. It's like, I sweated for 12 hours straight. I ate a hot dog out of my best friend's cargo short pocket for lunch, but this dinner is making it worthwhile.
Yeah, dude. Like, we used to do when I was younger too, and we used to do the conventions, like I would load up my, when you're young and you don't give a shit, like I would load up my backpack with like $1 Burger King or McDonald's burgers, and that was it, you know. That was, that was when I had an iron stomach. Now forget it.
Right.
Like if I have a
McDonald's, now I can't eat any of that. Now I eat nothing but salad. But in my dreams, I can still eat. I can still eat chicken sandwiches and hot dogs. But yeah, that would be literally like someone would go and get 20 hot dogs and put them in the back, and like when you had 5 seconds between customers, you'd eat a hot dog and get back to work slinging comics, man. But it, like we were talking about, the energy of conventions is so awesome. Like you get Isn't it a great convention, it just like pumps you up, and you just
it really does.
Can't wait to like either like as a fan read more comics or as a creator just produce. You know, that's like it really is like someone reading your books is really better than any drug that I could ever imagine. You know, it's like there's nothing better than someone like little message on Twitter or Instagram. Hey man, loved your book. I'm like, shit, that's awesome. I don't know you, random person, and you may be a serial killer bank robber, but dude, I, at this moment, I love you and thank you so much for like supporting my stuff.
Serial killer first, bank robber second.
Yeah, I mean, you got to have your priorities. You got to pay for what you love.
Dude, thank you so much, man. Where can everybody find you?
Mostly on Twitter. It's DB Andre. If you want to follow me on Instagram, feel free, but it's fairly boring there. It's just occasional book announcements and pictures of animals, chickens and dogs and cats and whatever else is roaming around our house here. But Twitter, yeah, I'm fairly active on that as long as that still exists. I have a Hive account that I haven't really checked, but it's set up. Yeah. But everywhere it's DB Andre.
Awesome, man. Listen, I appreciate you coming on, dude. I hope you had a decent time.
Yeah, of course. It was awesome. Love chat.
Cool, dude. All right. End the video. Thanks, man. I am looking forward to more. Rest assured, I will be at my local comic shop picking up issue number 6 this coming week. I have checked it off on my previews, and I will be purchasing it along with many other comics. My book of the week this week was Adventures of Superman, John Kent, number 2. Spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't read the book just yet. It's a really cool way of working in the Injustice video game story into the Superman multiverse and having it be part of like multiversal canon. At least I think that's where they're going. Tom Taylor does a great job of combining the seriousness of what the book is dealing with. Ultraman is basically killing every Clark Kent in the multiverse, and it's up to John Kent to stop him. Now, if you're up to date with your DC books, you know that Ultraman kept John Kent in a volcano for many years away from his folks. That's why when John Kent came back, he was already a teenager. I believe that he lost 5 years in that time span. So this is kind of cool. Like I said, Tom Taylor does a great job of combining the serious stuff with the lighthearted stuff. You can go check him out on Nightwing also, which is another phenomenal book. Always makes it to the top of my stack. I've also been watching a lot of Lone Wolf and Cub. All the movies are on HBO Max, and I've just been eating them up like popcorn based on the manga from the 70s. Listen, if you like cool rock and roll and samurai slash martial arts flicks with tons of blood and violence, then do yourself a favor, check out that Lone Wolf and Cub series. I definitely want to hear what you guys think about it if you decide to pursue my recommendation. As for our guest for next week, listen, you never know who might show up, but that being said, let's grow the show together. I want to hear your thoughts, your comments. Subscribe to the channel. You can find me at BTC Rich on Twitter, BTC Rich X on Instagram. I want to hear what you guys think. You know, I've been doing this for quite some time, slowly but surely trying to reach that 100 episode mark. Let me know what you want to cover. I'm going to be doing some more content, some toy stuff soon. I keep saying that every week, but it's going to happen. All right, guys, later.